Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the political party. There is less than a week until polling day in the 6th of May 2021 elections across Britain in Holyrood, the Senedd, Police and Crime Commissioner elections, Metro Mayor elections, City Mayor elections and all sorts of other elections across Britain. Hopefully you're registered to vote. If you're registered to vote by post, you can, by the way, take your ballot down to the polling station on polling day if for whatever reason you think you've missed the post. Or you won't get it there in time. So you can do that. I'm just trying to get as many people to vote as possible. And hopefully this podcast has helped. And today's guest is Labour candidate for the Metro Mayor in the West Midlands, Liam Byrne. Of course, a former, well, currently the MP for Hodge Hill as well, former government minister under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, a leading member of Ed Miliband's shadow cabinet. We talk about all that before we come on to what I discussed with Liam Byrne. One of the greatest threads in global podcast history, and indeed the present, and hopefully the future, is this thread on awkward places or strange places you've seen politicians or dared to talk to them. Pavitar Mann has been in touch. Now, we've had a few. It's always Labour politicians for some reason. We've had Carwyn Jones, Neil Kinnock, Stephen Kinnock, always specifically Welsh Labour politicians. But email the show, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Pavitar Mann has been in touch and said, I had the absolute pleasure of meeting Tony and Cherie Blair after being sat a few chairs down from them watching Labour of Love in the West End, during which there were a few quips about Tony and his time in charge. I was always worried about whether I should laugh or not. Well, that is very difficult. I went to see that play. I loved it. It's by the wonderful James Graham, who's been a guest on this show. Labour of Love featured Martin Freeman. It was brilliant. Tamsin Grieg as well. It was really good history of the Labour Party. And was, I think, the MP represented somewhere in North Notts because there was a forest scarf on stage as well. So, Pavitar, you brought back a lot of wonderful memories for me. But that, I mean, these are, we're talking big dogs that people have met here. Tony Blair, Neil Kinnock. So that must have been a bit weird, seeing Tony Blair in the audience of a play in which there is video footage of him and not knowing how to react. So if you have seen a politician in a strange place and indeed approached them, what? I mean, has it ever gone badly? Have you ever had a car crash moment with a politician? Email the show, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. And of course, talking about seeing Labour of Love in the West End, this show is coming to the West End with two nights at the Garrick Theatre. One of them is already sold out. So thank you to those of you that bought tickets to that. To reassure you, the audience is socially distanced, the venues are COVID secure, and it's all being done, obviously, within government guidelines. So the second date with Keir Starmer and Andrea Leadsom sold out. The first date is the 24th of May at the Garrick Theatre with Peter Mandelson and Saida Varsi. Tickets for that are flying out the door, as are tickets for the 2nd of June with Jess Phillips and Esther McVeigh. They're three amazing nights. The first two, I realise I've given you this information all over the place, the 24th and the 25th of May. So that's Peter Mandelson, Saida Varsi, and Keir Starmer and Andrea Leadsom are at the Garrick Theatre. 2nd of June with Jess Phillips and Esther McVeigh is at the Vaudeville Theatre, all in the West End, all very exciting. Please come along. You can get tickets for that. I've put the link in the blurb, or you can just go to mattford.com/live to get tickets. On to today's show with Liam Byrne, who is a phenomenal guest. And I remember meeting Liam when Labour were in government and he was a government minister. He was minister for the West Midlands when I met him. Really impressive, really deep and big thinker, really analytical brain, and has really thought about where Labour needs to be. And we talk about that. This isn't just a conversation about what's going on in the West Midlands, although it's a really good conversation about his campaign and whether he's going to win, and if so, how he's going to, what is the architecture of that victory? How is he going to get there and get over the line? Labour lost last time. Andy Street is the current mayor for the West Midlands. He was on this show a few months ago. He's running again. And I don't want to read it. There's a nice moment at the end of this, which is, I guess what this show is all about. But this is a brilliant conversation with Liam, not just about this campaign, although there's some really interesting and insightful stuff about this campaign and about the West Midlands and the politics of the West Midlands and how he manages that, but also his time in government and where the Labour Party has been since then. He was elected in 2004. Labour ejected from office in 2010. They haven't been back since. And obviously, these are years where he's been in his political prime. Now, we have politicians of all ages, of course, and that is a very, very good thing. So Liam Byrne has a lot of road left. But we do talk about that, about being in government and then losing a general election and, you know, many a good year spent in opposition, wasted in effect, and about where the Labour Party is now and where he senses it is and where Labour members are. Are they prepared to do the difficult soul-searching required and change course in order to win the next general election? But before the next general election, of course, there are elections on the 6th of May. That's in a few days' time. And I began by asking Liam about the parallels between this campaign and another campaign he'd been involved in. Delighted to be joined by Liam Byrne, the Labour candidate for the West Midlands Metro mayoralty, I guess is the full title. Liam, you're in another incredible fight. You fought Birmingham Hodge Hill in 2004. That at the time was seen as something that was going to define the leader of the Labour Party's fate. And here you are again in another seismic exercise that may well help shape how well or not the Labour leader is doing. Is there anything you learned from being in that ferocious by-election in 2004 that you can apply to this mayoral election in 2021?
Crack on and knock doors, I think.
Simple as that.
In many ways it is. You learn everything on doorsteps in my view. And the best of, as you'll remember, I mean, we won narrowly in a fairly unedifying campaign in 2004. And, we've got the biggest parliamentary majority as the Labour team now in the West Midlands. And the secret is knocking doors, doing residence meetings, school gate surgeries. I remember when I was getting to Westminster and being a sort of slightly disorientated sort of young man. And it was Siobhan Madonna, actually, who told me, just do coffee mornings. And so being, the sort of obsessive person I am, I did like coffee mornings every week for like 9 months. So I met almost the entire constituency. But of course, once you're in that mode of life, you just really zero in on that. And I've done them pretty much every month for as long as I've been allowed over the last sort of 16, 17 years. And it's no accident that the majority is the majority it is now, because you know, people are clever. You learn everything just listening to people.
I guess it's more from, looking at you, very few politicians get elected in by-elections, and they are unique. It's not like, it's hard enough getting selected for a seat anywhere, then winning it. Fighting a by-election is something completely different. It's an alien experience compared to a general election. And then fighting for a mayoralty is something different as well. So I think it's really interesting that you found yourself in two quite unique fights in a way that most politicians will never go through one of those things. And by the end of this campaign, you'll have been through two of them. I mean, do you think you're uniquely suited to these big fights in a way?
I've only just realised this now you've pointed it out. So thank you. So I'm not sure if it's a thing, but I don't know. I'm very lucky. The team I've got around me, we're very community focused. We're very sort of street level sort of people, really. And that's why we're doing what we're doing, because we just got so knocked off with this bloody Tory mayor who's done nothing over the last 4 years. And we've just watched things go from bad to worse. And so at the end of the day, for many of us in Birmingham and the West Midlands, politics is community work in a different, just in a different mode, really. We do see politics as an extension of community work, because it's, we're a very, in many ways, we're a very close-knit community of communities in our patch. We're a very diverse place, but, most different parts of Birmingham, most different parts of the West Midlands, I mean, they've almost got village feels still, actually, where people kind of know each other well. So I'll have to think deeper about that analogy that you've drawn.
What? Maybe it's just, I just thought it was, I'm probably completely wrong in trying to even, not that it's a narrative, but I just thought it's quite interesting that you find yourself just as a person in two kind of big, difficult fights in a career.
I do feel I've spent most of the last 5 years campaigning. So it just never stopped. I mean, it has been. I mean, there's an interesting point here, which is that, you know, since I was elected in the middle of a conflict. It was the middle of the Iraq War. My ministerial career was defined by the crash, and the last couple of years, this mayoral fight certainly has been defined by the contagion. And the truth is that, you know, since the turn of the century, we have been living in the age of the shockwave. So conflict, crash, contagion, you know, these sort of global forces have been roiling our politics. And that's partly why politics is so important right now.
I guess if I was to try and draw a conclusion, I would say, well, in politics, there are some people that dip their toe in. And they might stand for a council seat and then go, I'm never doing that again. You know, it's far too exposing, even standing for the local council. There are some people that will go through a by-election experience and go, oh my God, that was so intense. I never want to do that again. I guess the presumption was that actually you're a really tough person who can handle really difficult fights. And politics needs those people because I think that strength of character, particularly when politics is so severe, is quite rare. And I don't think the public appreciate how difficult it is to put yourself forward for any office. But I think by-elections are so hard. And I think these sorts of mayoral elections are so hard. It's so personal.
It is. But, you know, the truth is politics is a rough trade. And, you know, if you are going to survive in politics, you do need to grow the rhino skin, basically. And, you know, I've been in lots of fights over the last 17 or 18 years. It's the sort of fighting Irish in me, I suppose. But you do have to acquire the rhino skin in order to survive. But I think it's a lot harder now than it was. And it's a hell of a lot harder if you're a woman or from an ethnic minority background, because, you know, in many ways, you know, I'm a middle-aged white guy. So in many ways in today's politics, I have it easy compared to most other people who I work with in the West Midlands. And that does affect who chooses to go into politics. So I would not tell my kids to go into politics. I would not advise them. Very different to my own parents. You know, my dad was just so, you know, made up when I became an MP, and he was just sort of staggered that this kind of grandson of Irish immigrants could become a cabinet minister. That just all completely blew him away. But I'm not sure I would, you know, advise my kids to go into politics today, because, you know, the advent of social media, just it's so toxic now, politics, and it is so polarized. You've really got to look before you leap these days, I think.
Yes, but that's the problem, is you can look and it can maybe look fine.
No, maybe you're right. Maybe that is the wrong thing to do. Maybe you've just got to.
The problem is politics changes so fast that when you leapt, it might have looked okay. But by the time you're halfway down, someone has moved the pool or filled it full of sharks.
Yeah, no, I think, well, as I say, it's a very different environment to where it was sort of 5 or 10 years ago. But in a way, there's a hell of a lot more at stake now these days, because I do think that, you know, in all sorts of ways, politics is becoming so polarized now. You do have these supremacists, you know, on every sort of side of the fence. And without good people trying to build the common ground and actually plow a way forward with a strategic view of where the world is going, we're doomed, which is the subject of my forthcoming book, On the Road to Dystopia.
Yes, well, I was going to ask about that, which we'll give it a juicy plug at the end. When's that out?
I don't know yet. Well, no, so basically,
publisher's going to be livid.
My therapy during lockdown, I mean, you know, you have to do something sort of, you know, very, very early in the morning and very, very late at night. So my therapy has been to kind of pen this book, which is sort of coming in at about 110,000 words at the moment. And it tries to draw together a lot of the work I was doing on inclusive growth, on, you know, different sorts of economics, future of the social security system. But the starting point, I think, is true, which is that we're under such pressure from extremism of all stripes at the moment that there's a real risk that what happens is that nations do begin to break apart. and the global commons, whether that is airspace, outer space, cyberspace, becomes a hell of a lot harder to govern, to manage, to live in. And, you know, these are, you know, these are not the kind of mad fantasies of Liam Burton. I mean, these are planning assumptions for most of the world's military at the moment.
That would have been a great title for the book, The Mad Fantasies of Liam Burton.
Mad Fantasies of Liam Burton. Maybe that's the subtitle. Maybe that's the subtitle. Well, I'll put it forward and we'll see what they say. And if they pick it up, you'll get your commission, Matt.
Thank you. There's another challenge that's faced your generation of Labour politicians. And I think about this a lot, and it might not be the public's primary concern. In fact, I know that it's not. But you're elected in 2004, Labour win in 2005, and then they're out in 2010, and they haven't been back in since. You are a super bright individual, thinking about the world in these really creative and future-looking ways, as this new book shows. And just as your political career is starting to bear fruit, Labour rejected from office and they go into the wilderness. I wonder, just for you personally, and there'll be other people in that cohort as well, just how challenging that's been. You know, you were on a road at one point where you were going to put your services to the nation with really high office. And obviously you were able to do that for a period of time. But to then, in the prime of your life, effectively have that taken away. And I know, you know, politics is a rough business and everything. But that must be so disappointing, to have not been back in government since, to have not been able to put yourself to the service of the nation in that way.
Well, it's very nice of you to say that the career was bearing fruit. It felt to me at the time like it was just sort of one thing after another. So, you know, I was kind of between the Home Office, 10 Downing Street and the Treasury, it really did feel like it was just one, you know, insurmountable, intractable set of problems after another that I was being asked to go and fix. But, you know, I suppose I had a kind of a background that programmed me to go and do this. You know, so, you know, my mum and dad were in public life. My mum was a teacher. My dad was a council worker. And I think, you know, like many people who are in politics, you have an experience early on in life that kind of propels you in. One of those experiences I realised, one I didn't realise at the time. So, you know, when my mum died when she was 52, so just about, you know, a year or two older than I am now, that is a pretty early lesson in life that you're not here forever and you need to crack on with what you think you're here to do. And if you think that's public service, then, you know, you just need to kind of get stuck in, really. But, you know, after my dad died 5 years ago, I, you know, began really zeroing in on, you know, something that I'd hidden, you know, from everybody, you know, which is that I'm the child of an alcoholic. And, you know, I hadn't really focused on that. I hadn't really focused on what that does to you. But I, you know, I was in a pretty, pretty dark place after my dad died. And I came to see that being the child of an alcoholic is a thing. And you know, and many of the drives, many of the perfectionisms, many of the kind of much of the armor plating that I'd built for myself, every child of an alcoholic does that. Because you're sort of programmed to sort of try and put the world to rights. And when I sort of started talking about it for the first time in the Commons, you know, I was a bit of a mess. But the thing that really struck me after was that was how many other MPs that, and indeed peers, earls, in fact, came up to me and said, "Well, yeah, me too. I'm also the child of an alcoholic." So there is definitely something about that kind of upbringing, I suppose, those kind of childhood experiences that. That make you tough, make you fairly driven, and inspire you to try and put the world to rights, I suppose, in your own little way.
It's a weird thing with it, because it's such I can't imagine what you've been through with it, and losing your mum so early as well. It's so difficult. And grief is something that I think as a society we don't really talk about in any proper way. You just sort of, it's just accepted as a fact of life and we all have to get on with it. Now maybe that'll change as people become more thoughtful to each other, perhaps. But I just wonder, as a politician, it puts you in a different place, and it must be so hard for you to balance the personal and the political, because as a politician people look to you to talk about particular things, and it's good when politicians share those personal experiences. But does that bring its own pressures as well? You know, is the line between the person and the politician blurred in any way? Do you think actually, not that you've created a rod for your own back, because I'm sure you feel that you will do so much good for people, but sometimes you think, actually, I'm bearing a lot of my soul here. I'm talking a lot about my personal experiences, and that can come at a personal cost.
It did feel like that at first. It's got an awful lot easier. And the thing that you just don't anticipate, because, you know, why would you, is the people who then share their stories with you. And I found that really harrowing. And I had a sort of similar experience last year when, in the wake of COVID, it became pretty clear to us quite early on in Birmingham that COVID was having a much bigger impact on the ethnic minority community than anybody else. And so I, you know, have a couple of friends here like Paulette Hamilton and Sharon Thompson in Birmingham, who I've worked with quite closely over the years. And they said, well, look, this we've got to set up an inquiry to try and get the stories behind the statistics. And that was really difficult. I mean, these stories of pain and the agony of love and loss, that really, really was harrowing. But in a way, I think I'm grateful that at least public life is such now that we can talk about these things in public now. We can be more emotive and emotional in the stories that we tell. And if you're not moved by that, if you haven't got that sense of empathy, then you shouldn't be in politics, because, you know, there's that old, I think it was Duhamel who sort of said about the Fabians once upon a time, it, you know, they loved humanity. It was just human beings they can't stand. you can't be in politics and unless you actually care and love human beings. You know, if you don't, you're in the wrong business. Politics is a people business, you know. I think it's good that we can have, you know, not just sort of wonky policy discussions now where we're doing sort of graphs and numbers, but, you know, actually where we're talking about love and loss. You know, that's a better place, I think, for politics to be.
I've heard you speak about being the son of an alcoholic before, and you said when you're the child of an alcoholic, you're constantly trying to be the person who you think others want you to be.
Yeah.
So... It's a phrase that people often apply to politicians. So in a way, I'm trying to sort of find a positive. Did it help you develop as a person in a way that you think without that?
It makes you very driven. And, you know, and the truth is you do need to be pretty driven to, you know, to kind of crack on with politics. It was actually, so Callum Best, who's George Best's son, I mean, he's an extraordinary individual, and he does a lot of work with us with the National Association of Children of Alcoholics. He's a bit of a hero to a lot of us. He you know, in many ways, he helped get the movement going, and he wrote a brilliant book called Second Best. And it was Callum actually who helped me kind of understand this, that you are always trying to be the person that other. And so what that means is that you're constantly trying to calculate what do people want me to be here? What do people, and that is incredibly draining. And of course, you end up setting these utterly impossible benchmarks for yourself, which you then consistently fail to deliver. And so you do, you basically live in self-hatred because you are constantly feeling that you are failing. You constantly feel you're failing. And, you know, as you get older, that becomes very, very damaging. And I didn't really understand those dynamics, and certainly hadn't got a grip of those dynamics until, you know, I spent a lot of time in counselling after my dad had died. I got to a pretty, pretty dangerous place. And I had to spend a lot of time just kind of working on that stuff and working it out. And then, you know, and that then led me to take a very different path forward in politics. That's what then sort of took me to beginning to work with the homeless community in Birmingham. That's when I began to meet people who were self-medicating trauma in exactly the same way my dad was. He sort of slipped into alcoholism after my mum died. And, you know, and that's when I started meeting people who were, you know, almost dying on the streets. And that rage, if you like, that here in the second city of the sixth richest economy on earth, we had people dying on streets, that, you know, that's what then said, right, sod it, I'm going to stand for mayor, and I'm going to take on this Tory mayor who's not doing anything. So there you go.
Is there still a legacy of that? I mean, I've never had counselling myself, so I don't know how it feels to go through the sort of experience you've had and then talk about it and for that to help in that way. And you're doing that while you're a politician, so you're having counselling. Was this while you were in government?
No. This was after 2015. So
okay, but
you know, in a way, I had the kind of space and time to do it, and it was really, really painful. Really, really painful. I mean, you basically feel like you're juggling burning rocks, basically. while trying to climb a ladder. It's quite a difficult set of challenges. But yeah, I mean, I'm grateful I was able to get that help, you know, and it's one of the things that we're trying to address in our, you know, plan for the West Midlands, is to make access to mental health services much more widely available. And actually, when we brought Kia to Samwell College a few days ago, we got half an hour to just do a quick workshop with some students there on politics. And, you know, my inner teacher, you know, compels me to sort of get the pen out and start sort of asking questions on the whiteboard. And we were asking the students, you know, what were their sort of top priorities for young people? Mental health support, top of the list by a mile, absolute mile. So it's a really big thing for Gen Z, you know, and Gen Z, you know, you may have heard me talk about, I mean, I just think they're the most incredible generation, certainly the most entrepreneurial and collaborative generation we've had in the West Midlands since the days of Matthew Bolton and James Watt and the Industrial Revolution. But, you know, they've had the rug pulled from under them at the moment. But it was interesting that actually, you know, their number one priority, even ahead of free university education, you know, it was sort of twice as important as free university education. That's how serious it is.
And I don't want to dwell on all the sad stuff, but is there still a legacy of that? You know, that idea that you set yourself targets that are unrealistic. Is there still a part of that in you? Is there? I guess in a way, drive is a positive way to think of it. But do you still find yourself harbouring some of those instincts?
Yeah, afraid so. Definitely. My poor team. My team has to sort of pick it up. They have these sort of, you know, ludicrous. No, we. And this is partly, you know, I went to a failing, what was basically a failing comprehensive school, but I was sort of lucky enough to get a Fulbright scholarship to the Harvard Business School. And, you know, and that is kind of what they teach you at the Harvard Business School, is how to set targets and deliver them. So that kind of, that old slogan of Hannibal, we will either find a way or make one. I mean, that is very much the kind of ethos of our team, actually. And we've been really good at that actually during lockdown. You know, we've managed to run a kind of a mayoral campaign during lockdown, which has been pretty extraordinary. But no, I'm afraid so. You know, I'm afraid we're pretty driven. Because, you know, when you serve the most deprived constituency in Britain, you kind of sort of think, well, actually, people are paying you to go to work, and they, you know, they need someone to fight like tigers for them. So, yeah.
And do you think it's changed your perspective on life going through that experience with your dad?
Has it? Yes, I think it has. Yeah, it definitely has. I mean, it's, you know, I was a pretty hard bastard when I started in politics, which is why, you know, I was sent in to go and sort out the really difficult problem. So, you know, I was shipped into the Home Office as Minister for Police and Counterterrorism in the wake of Charles Clarke and the Foreign National Prisoners debacle, and yeah. John Reid declaring the Home Office not fit for purpose. You know, I then had 2 years to go and sort out the immigration system, rebuild the border agency. You know, that was unstraightforward, to say the least. And then by that time, Gordon was in Downing Street. You know, they'd formed a circular firing squad in Downing Street in the first 6 months. That was not a happy story. So I was shipped into Downing Street to go and sort that out, and then went to the Treasury to go and do the deficit reduction plan. So it was, you know, so it was a kind of one fairly stiff challenge after another. But but no, I mean, it's made me a lot. It's made me very. It's, you know, going through that experience has definitely changed me. It's definitely changed me, and I'm a lot happier. I'm a lot happier as a result, and I'm a lot happier in the work that I'm doing. And it led me to focus on very different things. It led me to focus on the work, you know, what became called Operation Compassion, which was the work we were doing for the homeless community and food banks. And the mayoral campaign basically grew out of that manifesto, which we call Radical Compassion, you know. So so it was a bit of a reset for me, you know. It was a bit of a reset.
Those years you describe, people remember it so clearly, John Reid and Charles Clarke, yeah. And then all that stuff. And then you mentioned Gordon coming into number 10. And I remember what precipitated Tony Blair's departure from number 10 was a letter written by Tom Watson and others and signed. And quite a few of them were in the West Midlands. There was Tom Watson, Sean Simon, David Wright, Khalid Mahmood. And it felt like that's where this kind of this plot had been incubated. Did they ever approach you to sign that letter?
No, they knew. They knew me well enough to know they wouldn't have gone very far.
They were very interesting times. I mean, I worked.
They were very stressful times.
I mean, in retrospect, I mean, you know, seeing the way things have gone since. And, you know, at the time, I was a member of party staff at the time, saying to people, you do this, you know, this crashes the car and you don't know if we're ever going to get back in. And I just think the signatories to that letter must just, they must regret it. They must regret. I don't see how they can't. I mean, I've never really talked to them in any great detail about it. But you think, Labour haven't been back since. And that's partly why.
Well, I think, I'm not sure about that because, you know, there was this global financial crisis that was unanticipated by everyone from Alan Greenspan down. So, I mean, that is the point about politics. I mean, you just don't know what is around the corner, do you? Which is why the character of leaders is so important because, you know, people like to elect people who can deal with the unexpected.
So post-2010 then, Labour in opposition, they haven't been back in government since. How frustrating was that for you with your politics? You know, you're centre-left, you weren't getting involved in any of the shenanigans and you want the Labour Party to be, you know, you're robust on things like immigration and the economy and crime and things like that. And you see Labour start to drift under Ed Miliband into a place where the public are not really backing them anymore. I mean, was that a frustrating period for you, the Miliband years?
Well, the whole 10 years has been frustrating because I've just seen, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I live in Birmingham. I go, you know, I think there was 1 week, even when I was in the Treasury, there was only 1 week where I didn't go home on a Thursday night and do a full stint in the constituency on Friday and the weekend. And, you know, I've just seen things go from bad to worse. But I do think, you know, and this is again partly what inspired writing the book, is, you know, the new Labour years in particular just did not grapple with this kind of exponential increase in inequality. And, you know, the institutions that we didn't create, you know, some of the policies that we didn't create, you know, we did not, you know, we just about managed to hold inequality in check during the new Labour years, but we didn't reverse it. And we didn't build an engine for reversing it over the course of the long wave. And that really has been, the sort of philosophical policy and economic question that I've spent a lot of the last 10 years thinking about. And, you know, I worked on that here and I'm lucky enough to work on it internationally. So I chair the Global Parliamentary Network for the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And we've put this question of climate justice, but also reversing inequality at the centre stage of that work. And it's been interesting because actually you do now have heads of the IMF and the World Bank that now share that agenda too. I mean, it began under Christine Lagarde, but it's accelerated under the new regime. So actually, you know, there is a recognition now amongst Western policymakers that 30 years on from the fall of the Berlin Wall, we have created a level of inequality that is almost exponentially increasing and which is incredibly dangerous now, not least because worlds which are very unequal are worlds which are very corrupt. And, you know, I don't think it's an accident that you're beginning to see the return of corruption and sleaze now. This is what happens when levels of inequality, you know, continue to multiply.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So what, just in terms of what the, you know, what that means for Labour and how Labour wins again and how does Labour get to a position where the country actually likes it and where the country thinks that Labour likes it too.
Yeah.
What should Labour be saying on the economy then? Because people always say, well, of course you're the party of dealing with inequality. We get all that. That's all baked in. We know you love the NHS. We know you care about inequality. Don't Labour need to talk about the other stuff as well? And why hasn't Labour been talking about the other stuff?
Well, they do. And in a way, you know, what we've tried to do over the last 12 months in the West Midlands is really get stuck into that question. So how do you, what does, you know, the next political, what does Labour's political project need to look like now? I personally think tackling inequality is at the core of it. And this is where I think there are two ideals that we find really empowering and inspirational for Labour activists here. So one is what we have to do around climate, but the other is the kind of rediscovery of our soul. So on climate, if you look at what Biden is doing now, and certainly the research we did with residents in the West Midlands, people know that we've got to go green. It's all, green is almost like white heat now. It's the future. It's inevitable. We can see bits of it happening. What we found is that people were really worried about whether green was more expensive and whether we needed to recover first and then go green. And what we found is the dilemma dissolves when you talk about making the things the world needs to go green. So we deliberately, one of our core slogans, in fact, it's probably our most popular slogan, according to our Facebook analytics, you know, our most popular slogan is bring back industry. We will not only lead Green Britain, you know, become the first net zero carbon city region in Britain, but we'll do that in a way that entails bringing back industry, making the things that the world needs to go green. Because as people say to us, you know, that's how we trade our way back to health. So there is a story there which is about reindustrialization and green industrialization that for the Labour Party, given our origins, given our roots, is of fundamental significance to our identity. But the flip side of that is this notion of Labour as the community party. So, you know, when we asked people, what's the silver lining from lockdown? What would you like to hold on to? Overwhelmingly, people said the resurgence in community spirit. People got to know their neighbours going out to clap on a Thursday night. Then they set up the WhatsApp groups and the Facebook groups for their street to make sure no one went hungry and lonely. But, you know, go to the food banks, go on to the sort of, you know, the food delivery networks. They're all Labour activists in there. Now, I became really interested in this. And of course, when you then sort of track it back to the very origins of working class organisation, first co-ops or the first trade unions, you know, on their banners were the words of Isaiah about everyone looked after their brother and said to each other, be of good courage. You know, Clement Attlee, 1919, the first book he wrote, The Social Worker, about his work as a social worker and a youth organiser in East London. So this aspect of our identity as the community party is something we need to rediscover and be proud of. So I think what we've really found and kind of clarified for ourselves over the last year of researching and campaigning is that soul of the Labour Party as the community party and a party that fights for reindustrialization allows us to square both the economic mission and the social origin of the party in a way that we think reconnects with voters. And frankly, you can tell that story inside 20 seconds on a doorstep. That's been fascinating.
But what about stuff like crime?
Well, crime is very much a dimension of the community identity. So people believe in robust approaches to crime. You know, I mean, Tony Blair's Great Rise, of course, was, you know, predicated on tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. But whenever you get into conversations about crime and the changing dynamics of gangs in particular at the moment, so at the moment, the advent of county lines and the glorification of violence that you see in social media have fundamentally changed the dynamics of gang violence on our streets. But people will say, yes, you do need a tougher police response, you need more police on the streets, etc. But, it, you know, in a beat or two, people click, but there's no youth work, is there? There's no youth centres, there's no youth workers. You know, probably our most popular specific pledge that we talk about is the pledge to put youth workers back in every neighbourhood, because people know that service has collapsed and they know what happens when you cut things like that. So I think people are much clearer now about the value of community life, and they know what it takes to protect communities and keep communities safe. They know what young people need in order to keep them safe from that. But the other thing that's been quite interesting is that people talk to us a lot about things like festivals and markets and parks and high streets, because what people want to feel is alive is community life around them. And there's that old saying that all politics is local. Well, now all politics is hyper-local. You know, for many people, their horizons are now reset, shrunk almost to the local park or the local parade of shops, you know, the immediate streets outside them, around them. And people want those spaces to be happy and sociable. So there's something really interesting that's gone on during lockdown, which is a really significant opportunity for Labour to grip and use it to help, you know, reinvent ourselves.
Your pledge on youth workers is one of seven pledges you've got, which breaks the old rule of having five.
I know. Well, it does, but there's seven boroughs.
So it's their fault.
We explain it as seven pledges for seven boroughs.
And is it just one pledge per borough? Does one borough get the youth workers?
No. We can afford to leave that to the voters' imagination.
That's like, what is it? Seven sons for seven daughters or something?
Seven
is that
the old... for seven brothers, man.
That's it. I'm too young for that sort of stuff. That's my defence anyway. Yeah. So seven pledges. And you're obviously trying to overturn a Conservative victory last time.
Yeah.
Last time, Labour's candidate was Shaun Simon. He ran a campaign that was basically take back control. That didn't work. A lot gets talked about how Boris won in London and the donut. Targeting those outer boroughs. What do you have to do to win in the West Midlands? Are there certain areas you're trying to target above others?
Well, we thought about this quite a lot in the beginning of the campaign, as you can imagine. And actually, what we decided to do is rather than target specific places, we are aiming at people who we think will vote for us. So the Labour coalition is obviously, you know, Labour's core voters, people who vote for us come hell or high water, people who drifted away from us in December 19, people who did vote for Andy Street last time round because they, you know, they actually thought that more people at the last election thought that the Tory candidate was called John Lewis than Andy Street. And I have the polling data to prove that.
That's true, or is that?
Yes, yeah, no, seriously. We ran YouGov polls back in sort of February 2000, whenever it was, 2017. And we said, you know, have you seen anything from the Tory candidate and who do you think it is? And literally, more people said John Lewis than Andy Street.
I wonder if that helped him.
Well, it did at the time. I mean, it's a different story now that John Lewis has closed in Birmingham and he was sort of unable to keep it open. So it's proved a very much a double-edged sword for him. But there's also, you know, there's a lot of Lib Dem and Green voters. I mean, there's about 44,000 Green voters at the last election across the West Midlands. We don't have the £1.3 million that Andy Street has spent. You know, we have much less than that. So we've had to run a campaign that is strong on every borough, but is aiming at, you know, particular voters who we know where they live, we know their propensity to vote, we know their voter ID. And so whereas Andy has been able to kind of get Royal Mail delivery of nice colour newspapers once a month, our strategy has been very direct mail based. So basically we have been direct mailing a voter pool for the last year. And we're now ringing them.
And you're trying.
Now that we've got teams back out on doorsteps, we're now making thousands of contacts a week, which means I know exactly what my data is and what my numbers are at the end of the week.
But that, I mean, trying to cover a constituency over a parliamentary term is hard. Trying to cover an entire region during COVID is, I mean, it sounds like you're doing very well, but it just must be so hard to run a campaign across such a geography in these circumstances.
It was hardest when we went back into lockdown in January. So, Jack Dromey is my campaign chairman. I mean, he is truly a hero of the revolution. And so we spent an immense amount of time, you know, after I was selected, just making sure that the Labour family was all on the same page. So actually building the unity of purpose across the Labour family, you know, we invested huge amounts of time in that. And, you know, I'm very lucky. My running mate, Simon Foster, is brilliant too. And we concluded to our Labour colleagues that we would try and do something that's never been done before, which is to run a fully integrated mayoral campaign. So everything that goes out, it's me, it's Simon Foster, but it's integrated down to ward level. So literally the direct mail that goes out, there are 228 different versions of it because it's customised to ward levels in order for it to carry the local councillors and the local council candidates on it. And so we philosophically, we genuinely wanted to kind of run as Team Labour aiming to create a Tory-free zone in the West Midlands, because we are, you know, we are still trying to take out the Tories in Walsall, Dudley, you know, and although it may be a little bit longer before Labour wins control of Solihull, you know, there is the potential for us to go into a Green Labour coalition in Solihull. So that took quite a lot of setup time, but equally it unlocked a completely different level of energy from the entirety of the Labour family, which is crucial for us because we rely on hand delivery of direct mail. You know, we can't just sort of drop 70, 80, 90,000 pounds with the Royal Mail to get our newspapers delivered. You know?
Like every family has its issues, the Labour family.
It does.
It's got a new dad in Keir Starmer. Is that the right analogy? I'm not sure. Or a new stepdad. I'm not sure how far I can stretch this analogy, but... Is it easier for you now being a candidate for an office like this, having Keir Starmer as the leader of the Labour Party, than it would have been having Jeremy Corbyn?
Well, yes, because, you know, the truth is in December 2019, you know, that was a setback in terms of the seats that we lost, and there are now Tory MPs in those seats. You know, and although, you know, the public has not seen much of Keir, they do respect him and they do know that he is leader of the Labour Party. I wouldn't say they know a great deal beyond that, but in a way, it feels to me like politics has almost been frozen for a year. And oddly enough, it's only in the last sort of week or two that it's begun to unfreeze, which is partly why I think you're seeing some of the volatility that we're seeing in the polls at the moment. People are beginning to zero in on this big choice. Politics is back, you know, after a kind of a year off in a way. People were really focused on other things over a lot of the last year, which is why we use that time to just talk to and listen to people. So, you know, the reason I'm able to run on a manifesto that's been written by over 10,000 people is we delivered hundreds of thousands of direct mail and we've made tens of thousands of phone calls to people. You know, people in this region are truly sick of the hold music on dialogue because we just spend so much time on it. But, you know, that now means I've got a manifesto that I can explain in under 20 seconds, which instantly people can relate to on the doorstep, because actually people on the doorstep have helped us write the bloody thing, you know.
Every Labour leader will face their internal critics who will talk publicly about how they disagree with the direction of the party.
Yeah, you're never short of advice if you're leader of the Labour Party.
Yes, indeed.
Great thing about the job.
But I just wonder about something you said there about people haven't seen much of Keir and they know he's the leader of the Labour Party and not much beyond that. Is that his fault?
No, I don't think anyone could have cut through the news environment. I know this because, you know, we put out three stories, three press releases a week. I mean, you know, what the stuff that we have done that has cut through has been pretty limited because it's just been one story for most of the last year. So, no, I'm not sure there's much else he could have done, to be honest.
And during those Corbyn years, a few Labour MPs left, set up the Independent Group for Change and all the rest of that. Were you ever tempted to leave Labour in that period?
No, I joined the Labour Party when I was 15. I joined the Labour Party after the miners' strike. As soon as I could join the Labour Party after the miners' strike, I joined. You know, and I grew up in the 1980s with the SDP, you know, running off and destroying Labour's chances to form a government. So, no, I'm a loyalist, basically. You know, I served on Jeremy Corbyn's front bench. You know, I was his shadow digital minister for a couple of years. So, you know, I just happen to believe that the person who members elect as leader of the Labour Party is the person that Labour MPs have to go and work for and support through thick and thin.
But even if they're getting investigated by the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, I mean, some Labour MPs just said that was a step too far for them, that anti-Semitism was so rife that they could no longer morally justify it to themselves.
But I think you choose your strategy for change. So, you know, we had, when we created the Tribune group of MPs, you know, a few years ago, this is something that we talked about a lot, you know, which is what is the right strategy for change? And actually, we thought that we could better address that pernicious evil by fighting from within rather than leaving from without. And I think history will show that we were right.
And where are Labour members now? I mean, you must be in contact with so many of them across the West Midlands.
Yeah.
Are they... where is their mindset? Are they saying, like, oh my word, we've really cocked it up these last few years, we need to move to the centre ground, otherwise we're never going to win again? Or are they still a bit like, well, I liked a lot of what Jeremy said, maybe we can have one more go with some of that stuff?
I think there's a pretty broad church, to be honest. I mean, I think what, I mean, I spend 3 or 4 sessions a day on the doorstep with activists who, some joined under Jeremy, some were members for much longer. The overwhelming sentiment for people at the moment is the anger and rage at what this government is doing. I mean, the social problems that are now escalating are so fast. People are just so angry about this. So that is the overwhelming feeling amongst Labour activists at the moment. And then they look at this kind of elitist crowd running the country, spending 60 grand on doing up a flat. And so I would say that they are very in touch with what is going on and what is going wrong at ground level in our country. They are incandescent at the people who are pretending to run the country at the moment. So I would say they're in a pretty gutsy and determined mood at the moment. And that is partly why you've also got the levels of unity within the party that you see at the moment. Certainly, you know, at the level that I work, what I see is a collective effort to just throw the Tories out. And that's what we're focused on here.
Are they prepared to do the necessary work in changing where the Labour Party is positioned in order to do that? Because all that passion and stuff was there under Jeremy. There was a lot of anger. In fact, a lot of anger repelled a lot of people.
My instinct is yes. I mean, because what I see is a determination to win. And I think, you know, there is a realism about the depth of the defeat in December 2019. And there is a real recognition that, you know, what Keir does have to do next is crack on with setting out what is that proactive Labour-shaped agenda for the future of the country. And in a way, I do think, and I talked to Andy Burnham about this, you know, the Labour mayors have got a unique role to play in this, because, you know, if you think about, take a lesson from Labour history, I suppose, if you think about the 1931 defeat, Herbert Morrison won control of London County Council in 1933. And over the course of the 1930s, it was London County Council, along with a lot of other boroughs, Labour boroughs around the country, that really pioneered and developed the municipal socialism that then went into the 1945 manifesto. So the 1945 manifesto didn't just sort of fall out of the sky. It was built on 10 or 15 years worth of experience in local government. And I think there's a real opportunity for us to take the best ideas from Labour mayors and Labour local government in England at the next election and turn that into a manifesto that wins. So I think the next 2 or 3 years is going to be really important in municipal life.
And you would rather be serving the Labour Party as the Metro Mayor for the West Midlands than playing a role in Westminster?
Well, I'm going to play a role in Labour. So, you know, I do believe on fighting for change on many fronts. I think we can, you know, there is a job to do in the West Midlands now. But of course, I hope that the ideas that we put into practice will be ideas that help shape the next Labour manifesto. And that's why, you know, I believe in fighting elections. It's why I believe in trying to govern. It's why I believe in writing books. It's why I believe in working closely with our trade union colleagues and social societies, because, you know, you've just got to push the thing forward wherever and however you can.
And what about this campaign then? Just to bring it back to this mayoral fight, which, you know, polling day is a few days away. The time is ticking by. I'm sure it's felt like a very long campaign to you. Do you feel like you're the underdog? And if so, is that helpful?
Well, we are the underdogs because we've got a Tory incumbent who has got money coming out of his ears. So, yes, we definitely are the underdog. But I think as people begin to zero back in on the election and the choice they've got to make, the idea that I think really captures people's attention is when we say, look, if you vote for the same old Tory mayor who works for the same old Tory prime minister and the same old Tory government, you know what we're going to get? More of the same. And more of the same is not what we need, and it sure as hell isn't what we deserve right now. So the, you know, the Tory chap here, he's taken a kind of odd decision to sort of try and stand up an election message, which is to go back on track. Let's get back on track. For most people in the Midlands, the idea that we go back to what we had before COVID is a pretty odd notion, because actually we had homeless people dying on streets. We had, you know, families living in hostels. We had unemployment going up. Where the hell do we want to go back to that? You know, so yes, we are the underdog in this. We are rebuilding the Labour movement from the ground up after what was a pretty seminal defeat in December 2019. But we're full of fight.
How big a role do you think the vaccine's playing in polling and people's perceptions? Because,
well, it's definitely played a role. I mean, I think I was looking at some polls on this the other night, and you can definitely see there's been a good, you know, 5 or 6 point bounce for them. And, you know, you've got to look at the counterfactual. So, you know, the three countries that really screwed up the initial stages of lockdown were the United States, UK and Israel. And actually all three of those countries have now got pretty well-organized vaccination programs. So they, you know, they, each of those governments in different ways learned a lot of lessons from what they got wrong the first time round. If the vaccine program had gone wrong or gone badly here, the Tories would be, you know, low 30s without a doubt. So, you know, the fact that it's gone well, you know, that has been worth sort of 4 or 5 points to them, but
it's given them a shot in the arm,
as they you could say that. But what you do notice on doorsteps, and this has become a lot more pronounced over the last 5 or 6 days, is how soft that vote is. So, you know, all local elections to an extent are about differential turnout. I would not be surprised if many of those people who, you know, are often traditional Tory voters decide to stay at home because they just can't bear to hold their nose and vote for this lot at the moment.
And what's your data telling you? Because I saw a poll in the Times or the Sunday Times.
Yeah, I saw that.
Put Andy Street ahead. And I just, with all these polls, I always think, how do you poll regions in this way? Not that I didn't believe it necessarily, but I just thought, it must be so hard to get reliable data at the moment. I mean, does that tally with what your returns are telling you?
No, it doesn't. And I looked at it in some detail because I was quite curious about it. And the truth is, you know, one of the legacies of 11 years of Tory rule here is that we have the worst digital literacy rates in the country. And therefore, it's going to be pretty challenging to do an online poll, which is what this poll was. And then you look at the borough breakdowns and you sort of think, well, you know, their numbers for Walsall, I think, had Labour on 9 points and the Tories on 80 points. And you just think, well, that's obviously mad, isn't it? You know, so it is, I think it is really difficult to do an online poll in an area that is as diverse as ours, particularly when, you know, a lot of our vote strength is based in the inner cities that just won't get picked up in a poll like that. And, you know, ultimately, you know, I get my data on a daily basis. I know how many contacts we've made each day and I know what our vote share is, which is why I think we're going to win.
As with any poll like that, it was accompanied by an unattributed quote that said, so pessimistic are Labour officials, they believe Byrne will not only lose, but quit politics altogether. Now, even just based on the last 49, 50 minutes we've spoken, I can't believe you're someone who's going to quit politics ever, let alone anytime soon.
They'll have to carry me out.
that has to be a made up quote.
No, I'm in this for the long term, you know, and when we lost in 2010, you know, a lot of my good friends decided to quit politics at that stage. You know, and I did my soul searching, you know, 10, 11 years ago. And this is what I think I can best contribute to, and this is where I'm going to stay and stay in battle.
Are you quite good at dealing stuff like that? When you see stuff like that, do you think, I bet I know who said that, or do you think that's made up?
I don't know, really. I mean, I think
that sounds like that bloke in head office.
No, I think, you know, I think when I was younger, I used to care about this stuff, and now I just don't.
It's a great feeling.
And the truth is, you know, if you work in food banks and if you knock on doors, you know, that's real life. That is real life. That's what keeps you grounded.
Now, I have to talk about something, which I know every interviewer says this, and you must dread it. But the reason I ask about it is I just think you were treated so unfairly. And actually, it drove me mad, because one of the reasons I set up this podcast, and I think one of the reasons people enjoy it so much, is because we sometimes treat politicians so appallingly. And all the fake outrage about stuff, sometimes I just think repels the public. And one thing I really like is when politicians joke with each other, or when you see them getting on. And one of my favourite photos is the one of John Major, Tony Blair and Paddy Ashdown. I think they're at a horse race or a football or a rugby match or something. And I loved the photos during the Brexit referendum of David Cameron and Paddy Ashdown and Neil Kinnock. And that note you left for David Laws, which is a historical joke that politicians in all offices have been leaving notes of that type. The generations.
Churchill.
and I was A-level history. My history teacher would tell me about this. I thought, oh, isn't that great? I love stories like that, that even for all its harsh contentions, in those little moments, there's just a little joke from two sworn enemies, basically, that there's a kind of levity there that I find reassuring. That makes me feel better about politics, not worse. And to have that hung over you, I've always just felt that you've been treated so badly for it. Now, I'm sure you're well over all that stuff, but it must have felt so harsh at the time.
Well, it's very nice of you to say all that. It was an error of judgment, nonetheless.
Was it? I don't think it was. I think you were right to do it.
When I was writing, I remember looking out over the cherry blossom in St. James's Park. And I was naive enough to think, because this is the tradition and the conventions of the House of Commons, that the private correspondence from one honourable member to another remains exactly that, confidential. But, you know, you can't live your life regretting these things. It damaged the Labour movement. I was, you know, very, you know, sorry about that. And, you know, the rest is history. David Cameron obviously liked to wave the note around, and we've all seen what happened to him. David Laws, the man who revealed it, was obviously done for an expenses scandal pretty quickly thereafter. And
the curse of Liam Byrne.
Lost his seat pretty quickly thereafter. George Osborne, who profited from it, he is also no longer with us. So I'm still here. make of that what you will.
Yeah, I suppose in a way you've had the last laugh. I just thought, I mean, that's it. You know, can you ever trust a Lib Dem? I guess that's the lesson.
Well,
I've got so many friends who are Lib Dems.
Let your listeners draw the conclusion from that.
I just thought it was so harsh.
But I'm still here.
Yes. And what was the public reaction to it? Did it ever register? Did people offer you sympathy?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, in Birmingham, people quite like people telling it as it is. People like politicians, they like their politicians to be fairly sort of straightforward. And genuinely, I mean, I know some people in the media don't sort of believe me when I say this, but I mean, we genuinely, this was one of the questions that we tested in all of our focus groups when we were preparing our message strategy. And we were really taken aback that people hadn't heard of it. So we would sort of say, you know, the note, the chap Liam was using the Treasury. And literally people would say, oh, was he there when Gordon Brown sold the gold? And literally more people mentioned gold than note, because no one could really remember it. And so it was a real lesson for us in the truth that the people who tend to bring it up and remember it are Tories. And second, most of the general public actually does not follow the minutiae of Twitter. And Westminster Twitter. It was a really salutary lesson, actually.
Must have felt quite nice, actually.
Well, it was a useful reminder about the fact that voters aren't, you know, following the ins and outs of politics anymore. And, you know, the people who do raise it are the same people who raise Gordon Brown selling the coal because they are Conservatives.
It's just such a shame that...
There you go.
My fear now is that people won't do that the next time there's a change of government, because they think, oh, this will be weaponized.
Oh, I hope they don't, Matt. I hope they don't. I hope they learn the lesson.
Well, I wonder if you beat Andy Street, whether he will leave a note for you.
Well, it's funny you say that. It's funny you say that, because, look, this is his accounts here. The combined authority that he runs is going broke. Literally, there's a £1.1 billion black hole in the budget. So, hate to be the one to tell people this, but combined authority under Andy Street.
There's no money left.
It's not been well run financially.
But I wonder if he'd... Do you guys, I mean, it's not the same this time because you're not sharing stages together. You're doing it all over Zoom.
We know each other. Andy and I know each other. So one of the books I wrote 2 or 3 years ago was A History of British Capitalism, told through the lives of 10 entrepreneurs. And I was trying to think, how do you bring the story up to date? How do you bring it into the 20th century? And we thought, for a nation of shopkeepers, good story to finish with is John Speed and Lewis. And so Charlie Mayfield was the chair of John Lewis, and Andy Street actually was the chief executive of John Lewis at the time. And they both very kindly gave me access to the John Lewis archives in Oldney, I think it is. We know each other from of old.
And how's that?
He's a very nice chap. I like him. On a personal level, I like him.
And have you managed to stay civil with each other?
Yes, actually. Obviously I'm someone who doesn't pull punches, but we've done about a zillion hustings on Zoom because hustings are now too easy almost to set up on Zoom. So we've done plenty hustings, which has been good. It's been very civilized. But that's it. But that's him. He's a civilized guy.
Well, that's so... I mean, that is such a lovely note to end on, because it's right that politics is robust and direct and, it doesn't pull punches, but still human beings involved. You should be treated like human beings.
We'll bleed.
We all do. Hopefully we don't have to test that theory with direct combat. We take it as read that we all bleed. And good luck in the final week of the campaign.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
And either way, it'd be great to have you back on in the future.
Yeah, love to.
All the best.
Take care.
Cheers, Liam. Well, there you go. Liam Byrne, I am sorry to every Lib Dem listening for that gratuitous jibe towards the end about not being able to trust Lib Dems. No Lib Dems, I hope, were hurt in the recording of this podcast or in the listening of it. And of course, Lib Dems are no more or less trustworthy than any other political party. Well, they're probably more trustworthy than some extremist parties. I've got myself in a right old tag there. I'm just apologising to Lib Dems. So Liam was a fantastic guest, and that was a really good discussion about so many things. I felt bad asking about the note, but as this is the first time he's been on the show, I couldn't not ask him about it. But I just think, he must be so sick of talking about it. But it's really interesting that for so many people, they don't even know about it. You know, people like me. Now, equally, I'm under no illusion that very little politics cuts through with the public, because when I worked in politics, that was also my experience on the doorstep. But some things do occasionally cut through, and it's not unreasonable to think that that might have been one of them, especially as Liam points out, David Cameron printed it off and wafted it around during the 2015 campaign. So they had at least 5 years. I'm sure there's a Conservative candidate out there now, probably in the West Midlands, perhaps, still referring to that note. So they've had a good old run of time with it. But it's interesting that hasn't pulled through in the polling. But also just how you deal with that as an individual to go through all that stuff. And obviously, as we discussed, Liam has been through far worse, and it's made him the person he is. And I thought that was the really interesting stuff. He's been through so much, losing his mum and losing his dad in the way that he did, and all the issues around that, and just the thinking that he's done about that and how that's influenced him as a person, him as a politician, and the sort of politician he is, and the stamina he's got. One thing that I think people really admire politicians for, some of them, is that drive. Some politicians just have so much drive and they can get up time and again, you know, through victory and through, crucially, through defeat and through setbacks and difficult times. And that is something we should all admire in politicians of all parties. So it's taken me far too long to get Liam Byrne on. That said, I have some guests coming up. It's taking me even longer to get on. And of course, that will always be true. So before I slip into the usual cliches about I could have gone longer than an hour, this is someone I've wanted to interview for, you know, quite some time. I will leave you to it. Just a few days to make those all important decisions. I love elections. I hope you get a buzz from it as well. I hope you're registered to vote. And as I said at the start, don't forget, if you've got a postal ballot and for whatever reason you haven't got round to it or you got it late and you think you've missed the post, you can walk it down to the polling station on polling day, on Thursday the 6th of May, to your polling station or your polling place and deliver it that way so that you don't miss out. So hopefully everyone listening to this is going to vote. It's going to be a festival of democracy. I've got a few more guests before polling day, and we'll do some analysis afterwards, as well as the usual mix of politicians from all across the political spectrum. And do get in touch and recommend anyone you'd like to hear, because sometimes it does just prompt me to think, I haven't thought of someone like that. And that email address, as always, is politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. I shall leave you for now. Have a wonderful weekend, and I'll see you soon. Ta-ra.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.